Welcome to the Social Justice Salon. I am your hostess, Marianne Moore, a social justice advisor and political philosopher passionate about recreating our world. In this podcast, we will evoke the grand revolutionary salons of the past by engaging with thinkers and practitioners about social justice issues, showcasing grassroots activism, diving into theory and grounding ourselves with everyday methods to affect real-life change in society. Join us and we will furnish you with the knowledge and clarity you need to understand and improve our world. Let's enter the salon. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Social Justice Salon. I'm really excited because I have been, over the last few weeks, just working out the next few guests on the podcast, and we've got some really, really good guests coming up, so that's very exciting. I think you'll like them and the topics, but I won't reveal it just yet because I don't want to jinx it. I want to make sure that they're all recorded and everything's fine. Needless to say, I think it's going to be a good few next episodes. And this episode is going to be just me, so it's me solo, and I'm going to be talking about ways of knowing. So this is something that is really important in terms of research, consultancy. When I was running Justice Studio, something that we took very seriously in terms of ensuring that we thought about the philosophical understanding of how you know things, because how you go about trying to work out the truth is important. This all feels very abstract, but I will talk about how we can make this more practical. But ways of knowing is our topic. I hope you'll find it interesting. It really is an important underpinning, I think, to most of our practice in social justice. And if we don't pay attention to the philosophy behind how we use our tools and what our tools are, then we can end up causing harm rather than doing good. So let's get into the topic. I hope that's abstract enough for you. This is all about ways of knowing. What do I mean by ways of knowing? Well, what I'm talking about is the theory behind knowledge and the tools that we use and the assumptions that we have about how we get knowledge, how important knowledge is, and what knowledge consists of. And most of this became problematic in the Scientific Revolution. Now, the Scientific Revolution happened around the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe. And what is important is that at this time, European colonial expansion was happening, and it became a massive focal point. And also at this time, women were being accused of witches, and there was this massive femicide of women under the guise that they were witches. And this time, which was meant to be the Enlightenment time, was a time when most of our modern assumptions about knowledge were formed, and they still impact how we think today. And what is really important is that they were informed at a time when there was colonialism, there was mass misogyny, and white men decided how knowledge should be gained. And it had this whole racial and gendered edge to it. So I'm going to talk about that first, and then I'm going to talk about how that has been challenged by feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial viewpoints and tools. But first of all, as you know, I love history. Let's get into the Scientific Revolution and these white guys who kind of messed everything up for us later down the line, as far as I'm concerned. So in general, there were some famous men who started the Scientific Revolution. And these were our white, rich men from Europe. Galileo, Newton, Leibniz, Bacon, and Descartes all saw the world as mechanical. And they juxtaposed what was scientific with what was other, which was nature, women, and indigenous people. And they set these people up as things to be conquered, as science being able to dissect them and to understand them. So these men wanted to be the lords and masters of nature, which was essentially borne out in being the lords and masters of women, the lords and masters of indigenous people, and the targets that they had in colonialism. And so they set up all of their knowledge base with these kind of problematic assumptions at the beginning. I want to look at a couple of these men. First of all, one of my favorites, René Descartes. So he was around in the 17th century, and he was based in Amsterdam, and he's known as the father of modern philosophy. He was basically a sickly child. He had a pasty complexion, and his mother died sadly when he was just a year old. So he was raised by his father, but his father sounds like he was kind of pretty horrible to Descartes and made him feel like he wasn't a man. So perhaps the desire to prove his strength and virility to his father was what led Descartes to become what he was famous for, which was all about a philosophy that would help master nature, help men master nature. So he thought this would mean that it would lead to freedom. And for him, this basically meant freedom from drudgery, prejudice, pain, and disease. He wanted to basically defy nature by extending life and correcting any errors in thought. His most famous phrase was cogito ergo sum, or I think, therefore I am. And this phrase has been passed down from generation to generation. So Descartes believed that his mind proved that he existed. And he really popularized this idea that there is a separation between body and mind. So whereas he was his mind, his personality was his mind, he thought, he just had a body, but the two were completely distinct from each other. And so this was what started, or at least popularized, this idea that the world didn't have any inherent spirit to it, and it was really just a machine. And his colleagues also, as I said, saw the world as mechanical. So basically there was this idea that men could kind of push buttons and make the machine, the world, operate as they wanted it to. Now, Descartes was really obsessed with rationalism. So rationalism puts abstract concepts at the heart of knowledge. And by elevating the idea that the mind is superior to the realm of the body, he basically said that reason was the most pure and wonderful thing. And not just that, but that reason was a man's thing. And there was this sense that anything that these scientists did was objective. It was completely divorced from any other surroundings. It was completely divorced from their viewpoint. And it was completely the opposite of something which was subjective. Subjectivity was seen as something lesser. That's where you saw something from your own particular viewpoint. And there was this kind of complete miss, like a complete blind spot, that these men might be ever seeing anything from their particular point of view. They believed that they had complete objectivity and that anyone else, like a woman or an indigenous person or anyone of the lower classes, if they said anything, then they were talking from their own particular subjectivity. But these white, rich European men were obviously thinking from complete objectivity. It's completely fallacious, but this is basically what we still somehow randomly believe. And what he did, or what the whole of these scientific men did, was to kind of have this binary distinction between reason and emotion, objectivity and subjectivity, and the mind and the body. And everything that was considered emotional, subjective, of the body, or of matter was considered lesser. Francis Bacon, around in England in the 16th and 17th centuries, is known as the father of modern science. And he was influential in the Royal Society, which is where all the scientists like to hang out. And he was also the founder of the inductive method, or they said he was. So this is one kind of reasoning. Descartes had used a different kind of reasoning, deductive reasoning. He basically said that he realized that he had thoughts, so he deduced that if there are thoughts, there must be a thinker, and if there is a thinker, then there must be an existence. And if there is an existence, then Descartes himself must exist. But the second type of reasoning is this induction. So this makes a generalization from what we observe. So if, for example, we found that Francis Bacon was a misogynist, we might infer from this that all of the men of the scientific revolution were misogynists. Such inferences are not necessarily logically valid, because there may be scientific men who weren't misogynists, but they are revealing. The interesting thing about Francis Bacon is how he talked about nature in these really feminized terms. So he constantly referred to nature as a, quote, common harlot. And he said, nature must be bound into service and made a slave and put in constraint. There's one passage where he says, quote, likewise, for the further disclosing of the secrets of nature, neither ought a man to make scruple of entering and penetrating into these holes and corners when the inquisition of truth is his whole object. End quote. So rationalism, together with objectivity and the importance of experimentation and observation, birthed the key principles of modern science that we still hold today. And once scientific man had decided that his viewpoint was objective and all other viewpoints were subjective and biased, they were easy to discredit. Any other differing of opinion from that of the, quote, objective was deemed, quote, subjective and therefore wrong. Rationalism, objectivity, and reason were labelled masculine and superior, and emotionalism, subjectivity, and the illogical were labelled feminine and inferior. So in this way, scientific man could ignore everyone else's views, safe from having to acknowledge or confront the true subjectivity of his own viewpoint. The importance that science has placed on abstraction, logic, observation, and objectivity is rooted in its love of separateness, this mind and body dualism. Science is the key to knowledge, and as Bacon said, quote, knowledge itself is power, end quote. And knowledge is at its most powerful when the path to it is considered an exclusively male ability, and you only define as knowledge things that are branded masculine. Of course, a science based on separation and objectivity would never be able to comprehend other mystical and supernatural forces of knowing, such as the paranormal. Indeed, they've all been so effectively slandered that it even feels alien to us to comprehend that there might be some use in them. Yet, many of the practices that have been dismissed as magic or superstitious are actually more wholesome ways of seeing and connecting our minds to our bodies and to other people. For example, to intuit is to feel that you know something without having any explicit theory or reason for it. You just know. And another important system of thought is mind reading, not the TV magician kind. This is kind of the attribution of hidden mental states such as wanting, fearing, thinking, and knowing and hoping to another person. It can often be something that we do subconsciously, but we can sense what's happening with somebody else. We register their facial expressions, where they reach, where they glance. And as we detect tiny inflections in their breath, eye, and movements or tone, we get a good sense of what's going on inside of them. Without a capacity for mind reading, we'd be stuck looking at surface patterns of moving limbs. And so it's of enormous importance that we know what other people want and whether they are friendly, angry, or impatient. Whilst we don't always get it right, it makes up a large part of our knowing experience. It even has its own part of our brain. And so it's quite funny, because given how white male's experience is usually one where he is navigated around by other people rather than him having to do the navigating himself, you can kind of almost see why these things such as mind reading and intuition wouldn't have got the credit and importance they deserve. And especially considering this idea that the body is nothing, that it's not important to have desires or passions or listen even to your body and the messages that it might have, you can see how intuition would be downgraded. This idea of a separate mind that has been sold to us was never the real deal. In fact, everything is connected and relational. Thinking is a vast, multifaceted process that includes feelings, creativity, speculation, intuition, cognition, analysis, and computation. All of these things are valid. True knowledge can only come from ensuring that all thought is appreciated. So how does this play out practically today? Well, in practice, in the industries that are meant to be concerned with social justice, such as socio-economic research and international development, there is still a preponderance of a desire to have a knowledge base, which is coming really directly from the scientific revolution men. So we certainly saw in the late 1950s and the early 1960s that things like evaluation and research, which happened from Western countries onto former colonized countries, focused on educational assessments or kind of capital intensive growth and technology transfer and how these things were happening. So there were loads of economics and cost benefit analyses in the 1960s and 70s with this idea that development could be something that is tangible and measurable. And within this viewpoint, this really has kept going up until the 21st century, where there is this real reliance on measurement of quantitative data, so the numbers of things that can be counted, with only minimal allowance for qualitative aspects. And the things that we see in this kind of traditional evaluation and research methodologies, they're all about the search for objectivity and this kind of, quote, scientific approach, standardized procedures, values which are all about the priorities of the evaluator, which underlie this kind of Western and global North viewpoint. There is this over-reliance on quantitative measures. Qualitative aspects are downgraded, and being difficult to measure, they just tended to ignore them. And within these kind of research projects, there's a high degree of managerial control whereby managers can influence the questions being asked and they're not being evaluated themselves. And then other people who may be affected by the findings in evaluation may have little input either in shaping the questions or being asked to reflect on the findings. Outsiders are usually contracted to be evaluators in the belief that this will increase objectivity, but this can also mean that they are far less able to understand the participants. And so feminist, anti-racist, anti-colonial and queer methodologies are really about shedding a light on this former process. They show how our ways of knowing are directly related to the power structures that exist in society, and that these power structures need to be acknowledged, brought into the light, and dismantled in order to create a more equitable power base. So what does this actually look like? Well, first, let's acknowledge. We live in a world that is structurally unequal. So certain groups of people have more cultural status, social value, and structural power than others do in our society. The world is hierarchical. It is patriarchal. Men hold a disproportionate amount of structural power, influence, and wealth, and our world glorifies patriarchal values of domination and control and these masculine ways of knowing. We live in a white supremacist world where white people hold a disproportionate amount of structural power as well. They have disproportionate influence and wealth and a historical legacy of colonial oppression and slavery, which perpetuates racial stereotypes. We live in a capitalist society. Our world is organized by and glorifies private property, land ownership, capital and wealth accumulation in the hands of a minority of people. It is privileged towards the able-bodied, older people and disabled people, those with physical or learning disabilities, and those with mental health issues are often marginalised, discriminated against, and exploited. It is cis heteronormative. Our world promotes this binary gender as the norm, and heterosexuality as the normal or preferred sexual orientation. There is ageism. Adults control power, status, and wealth, and they control what children do. And our world is inherently disrespectful of our natural environment, seeing animals, plants, and land as resources for humans to use. And you can see this comes directly from the way that Bacon has seen nature and the way science has seen nature. So when we come to do research or consultancy, it is important to acknowledge the power dynamics and also understand the intersectionality between all of these different oppressions and power relations. So in any type of research or consultancy project, you have to consider, before you even start out, in how you design the entire thing, whether or not it already has power imbalances laden within it. All different qualitative and even quantitative research methodologies are heavily laden with potential power imbalances because the researcher usually defines, initiates, and ends the interaction with any of the participants. To high levels of education and status, they tend to set the research agenda, dominate interactions, and control what data is collected, how it's analysed, and how participants are represented in the findings. And general researcher participant power imbalance is even more stark if the participants in the research have less power and less status in the world. So in terms of designing and thinking about power and knowledge within a research or consultancy project, relational ethics is really important. Relational ethics is the understanding that the research relationship necessarily involves an interactional encounter between the research and the participants of the research. It understands that the research itself should be relational rather than extractive. A common assumption behind this relational research is that statements made by any research participants should be explored from the perspective of a cultural and societal context which they are embedded, rather than implying a kind of Western-centric or male white lens. Relational ethics acknowledges that what we assume as, quote, objective is instead based on power structures that have come to define which ways of thinking and acting are, quote, objective, and which ones are, quote, subjective. So it means building a dialogue and understanding the existence of multiple perspectives on the same issues can coexist. Within research and consultancy, it is so important to acknowledge this imbalance of power and privilege, and therefore ensure that no one is exploited, harmed, disrespected, or given less value or made to feel controlled through the methods. The whole relationship between research, science, and those who are participant in it needs to be rebalanced from a position of power over to a position of power with. Then reflexivity refers to the self-aware analysis that there are dynamics between a researcher and the participants, and that the whole identity of the researcher and their positioning can impact on the research process. It's not like this objective thing that happens in a vacuum. We are people coming to another situation, and by just being there, by even asking questions, by even our presence, we are changing something from what it was to something new by the interaction that we are having. So we need to understand this kind of two-dimensional, interrelational experience where our own biases and prejudices are interacting with our participants' behaviours, and how they are simultaneously perceiving us is impacting how we are behaving ourselves. All of this needs to be considered. We are relational. We are not a scientist looking at an object. And then positionality is really important as well, because we need to think about our own subjectivities. Rational, scientific man thought he was objective and not subjective. He could not see that everything he was designing had everything to do about his own position in the world, his own privileged position in the world, and what he valued. And so when we come to it as researchers or consultants, we have to be aware of our own subjectivities and what assumptions we are coming with, what our kind of like normative conceptualizations are, what assumptions we already have, what our histories are, how our experiences might impact on how we are doing our research. And acknowledging we can never, ever, ever, unfortunately, we can't be objective. And so acknowledging all of this, there has been, in the last 50 years or so, a real move to start to confront the scientific or the traditional way that research and consultancy is done. And there have been a number of different methodologies. So there's a feminist methodology, there's anti-racist and decolonial methodologies, and then there are queer-led methodologies, which all try and disrupt the usual way that we think about research. I'll go through them one by one. Applying a feminist approach is not simply about focusing on women and girls. It's a set of methods that challenge patriarchal ways of knowing by stating that the experiences, thoughts, feelings, and perceptions of all human beings are valid and must not be excluded from our understanding. So feminist research is based on creating a trusting and egalitarian relationship. It's between the research person and the research participant, and it has an avowed commitment to non-exploitation of participants. And so feminist methods can be a refreshing antidote to more traditional and, quote, extractive methodological approaches. Anti-racist and anti-colonial methodologies acknowledge that research, and particularly anthropological methodologies, have long been tainted by racism and a colonial lens. And so to counter this, they use anti-racist and anti-colonial methods to ensure that the agency of the participants is protected. It inherently acknowledges the intersectional character of identities, as well as the oppressions experienced by populations of colour. At its centre has this awareness of the power that research and evaluation has to perpetuate and challenge discriminatory social practices. And so the whole research approach is based around increasing accountability by revealing and rebalancing the asymmetrical power relations that currently exist in the world. Alternative approaches to things such as evaluation have owed much to the developments in Latin America and Asia and Africa in the 1970s, 1980s, and more recently. So many of these kind of approaches take a more relational and action-based approach to research, where researchers might be embedded or ingrained or working alongside the people and the communities and the environments that they are researching. And much of this relational-based inquiry is about trying to ensure that the context and the program site is an important element of the research. So it's important not just to collect information from people, but also think about their values, their beliefs, their customs, their spirituality, and the general characteristics of their perceptual space, which can include living and unliving people. And seeing things from, for example, an African perspective in this relational method, things such as spirits, witches, sacred places, and the universe are part of this material reality. And so a relational-based approach will respect these kinds of ideas. Thinking about how can we have inquiry into this non-material reality is, for example, thinking about how can we ask questions which are about happiness, about harmony, and about peace. And also thinking about logic in a more circular way rather than this linear logic of traditional Western evaluation methods. This is something that then leads back into the feminist approaches and also is similar to the way that we think about queer approaches. queer approaches challenge the dominant structures of knowledge production. Quote, queering and quote, decolonizing ethnography share the need to overcome heteronormative ways of knowing through research. So this can involve challenging hegemonic constructions such as the gender binary, which have led to the marginalization of non-normative actors in the world. Queering methods also involve challenging the presupposed stability of the researcher themselves and recognizing how we as researchers affect and are affected by the research experience. Now, because we still live in a world which thinks that science is rational and objective, we also have a kind of imbalance between the types of methods that are used in research and consultancy, and in fact, everywhere, really. So people tend to place more value and power on numbers and statistics and quantitative methodologies than they do on speaking qualitative research, such as interviews, focus groups, or collaborative ethnographic research. And so a lot of the practice around trying to ensure that research is ethical and that it's equitable is also around challenging the kinds of approaches that we think are better than other ones. Episode 5 of this podcast is called Equitable Quantitative Research. And in that episode, we talk a lot about how quantitative research is not inherently objective. It can be sliced and shaped in many different ways. And yet, quantitative research is still considered more masculine than other types of research. And this is all based on this whole conception from the scientific revolution. So a lot of the alternative methodologies are not just about ensuring that things are ethical. It's also about ensuring that we are using a variety of approaches and that we are not valuing one approach above another. I think that actually the way to get to the closest we can to objectivity, we have to acknowledge and use a number of different methods. So we have to use quantitative data and qualitative data. So when using quantitative data, which can include surveys, demographic attainment and other statistics, we have to be aware that statistics are not value neutral. We have to take a critical approach and acknowledge that there are potential limitations and biases in each case. But let's just look at this a bit more practically. So let's imagine the whole process of a project. The first thing we need to do is think about, does this actually need to happen? If we're taking an anti-racist and anti-colonial approach, we need to be aware that for certain communities of color and in certain places of the world who have experienced colonialism, they have had so much extractive experiences of researchers, anthropologists, medical trials, and people feeling that they can do whatever they want to these populations. And so if we're going to be cognizant of that kind of colonial and historical legacy of oppression, then we need to actually think, do we actually want to do this research in the first place? And many times it might be no, we don't want to do this research. And that is a really important point. Instead of doing more research, is there already research out there? Or can we first ask people if they want to be a part of something? So I think just at least acknowledging that a research or consultancy project doesn't need to happen is an important part of being more equitable. And then once we have decided that we definitely do want to do this research and it's necessary to do this research and the people that we are going to have participate in the research are up for it, it's important to consider who the actual researchers are. Depending on the topic that you're looking at, who your researchers are, is going to be so important for understanding the power dynamics and for replicating or opposing different types of power. So thinking about the gender of our researchers, or the sexuality of our researchers, or the color of our researchers, or the educational background or the class background of our researchers. All of this kind of thing can help to ensure that any participant that is involved in the project is feeling comfortable. They're potentially much more likely to talk to somebody who looks like them or understands them or comes from the same background. So we need to think about these things and also of the biases and the ways that these researchers are operating. Then we want to think about the methodologies. So we know that quantitative research is considered better because it's considered masculine, but there is really important things that we can use in quantitative research, and especially if we complement this with qualitative research, such as focus groups and interviews with people, then we're going to get a much more rich data. I always think the quantitative data as being the skeleton and the qualitative data as being the flesh. It kind of puts together a whole picture. So feminist approaches to interviewing acknowledge power, control, and vulnerability within the interview setting. So we have to understand that the entire process of the interview is there to rebalance any kind of power dynamic that might be there if it had been more of a kind of researcher doing research to the participant. So ensuring that people feel comfortable to express their experiences openly, ensuring that the interview has a positive impact on the participant, is really important. Focus groups are a really important part of queer and feminist and anti-colonial and racist practices because focus groups are a way to redistribute power. They redistribute power from researchers to participants. And they, because the research participants outnumber the researchers, there is this whole feeling that instead of studying the participants, actually the researchers are engaged in a discussion. Even though the researcher still retains a powerful role within that setting, their influence is reduced because they, as one or two people, have much less power over a group than an individual does. Focus groups can end up feeling more like an exchange of information and a discussion rather than research being done to you. And for the participants in the group, you can get solidarity and power and strength from being with a group of people that might have had a similar background or similar experience to you. So it is a really important way of rebalancing the relationships. Participatory research, which has come out more recently, is a kind of inherently more co-productive and therefore more ethical way of researching. It has co-design at its core. It's about creating the research scope, methods, and outputs with the participants rather than us researchers kind of doing research to participants. So it's an exciting way to ensure that research is an empowering and inspiring process rather than one which is extractive. It can include training participants as peer researchers and co-designing methodologies, using peer-to-peer interviewing techniques and community surveying techniques when the whole community gets involved. This kind of changing the power dynamic can be really, really impactful. Although, of course, there's also the need to ensure that the burden is not placed on the participant or the community to do way more than they should and not get paid for it. So you obviously have to ensure that there is some compensation or there is some way that this whole thing is not then put on the participants. And also you have to be aware that it takes a much longer time than if you are just, quote, doing research to other people. And this is a really important point because how the research feels to the participant should be the most important thing. Have you ever felt as if somebody was just trying to get information out of you and they didn't care at all about how that made you feel? Often we might have to talk to people about things that have happened which are very traumatic for them. And the difference between ethical research and extractive research is that the person who has been talking about their experience feels at the end of it either like it's been a cathartic healing process or a process which has left them feeling more traumatized. And often when I've been doing research with groups or people who have just a lot of burdens and a lot of things going on. So for example, doing research with people who are activists who are movement building, it's important to make sure that they don't feel like it's another thing that's being put on them. But the whole process, I think, of research, in order to be equitable and ethical, it needs to consider that the ways that we understand other people should be a kind of reciprocal process, and the whole experience should feel restorative. If we can do that in a way which is an actually enjoyable, pleasurable, fun experience, and one that can give back to them and make them feel more restored and whole through the process, then that is just so much better than something which feels extractive. And once you've picked the methodologies that are going to most reflect the kind of power dynamics that you want to recreate, and we're hoping that these are equitable power dynamics, what's really crucial within these methodologies is the questions that you're actually posing. So thinking about, where are the questions coming from? What kind of assumptions are there? What kind of language is it? Is it language which replicates the gender binary? Or is it language which has certain kind of old school, colonial, or derogatory assumptions within it, which might offend people as they are being interviewed? And what is the order that you put the questions in? What kind of arc and what kind of feeling do the questions create? One of my massive bugbears is whenever I was interviewing young people, especially if they were in the criminal justice system or who had been really victimized, there are all these really official diagnostic tools which ask the young people how they feel. And they are written in such a way that if you read these questions to yourself as an adult who doesn't have the same difficulties, they make you depressed. And so can you imagine, or I think, imagine how depressing these diagnostic tools are to listen to kind of answer, like, you know, how many times have you felt sad in the last week? Or how many times have you harmed yourself in the last week? These kind of questions. How that question is framed is so problematic. And so when we're thinking about making sure that research is equitable and ethical, the arc of the questions is important. What questions you're asking first, what questions you're asking in the middle, what questions are you asking at the end, and how are they framed? What is the general feeling that the participant will come away with from that interview, for example? And the most important thing is that the framing of those questions and the order of those questions do not create more harm. They do, in fact, create a space for the person to be able to talk through different things and end up feeling better from the experience of the interview. And we're not done, because where we're asking the questions is important. Where are the focus groups being held? Are they being held on neutral ground? Are they being held in a government office? Are they being held in a church? Are they being held in somebody's house? Are the interviews being overlooked by people? Is the quantitative data being recorded on the computer where it might be hard for people to access? There are so many different considerations when we think about where research takes place. And that can either enhance an extractive power dynamic, or it can create to a feeling of feeling calm and feeling open and feeling as if this is something which is happening on the participant's own terms. And finally, what happens with the research? This, I think, is one of the biggest things that researchers and consultants don't ever think about, and people who commission it. They don't think about the fact that once it's done, where does this information go? And sadly, so often, this information gets put in a report, and the report gets put on the shelf, and nothing ends up happening. And the people who have taken their time and often bared their souls and given their ideas to this piece of research are left completely in the dark about, did anyone ever read it? Did anyone ever listen to me? And is this ever going to affect any change? Sadly, often the answer is no. And that's why we should also think about why are we doing this stuff in the first place. Because if we can't at the beginning see a really good reason for doing it, and if we can't track and set out a way of the people who are involved in the research to get answers to what is happening with their important data that they are giving, then it really shouldn't be happening. The most important thing, I think, is for people to feel like they've been heard, and especially if they've taken time and consideration in giving their thoughts. We have to, if we're going to be doing equitable and ethical research and research which tries to challenge power dynamics, give back to them, feed back to them what has or hasn't happened in the research, whether or not it's been actually read, whether or not people are going to take on the recommendations, or whether or not, sadly, they aren't. And in an ideal world, if the research has led to recommendations, which has led to a proper action plan and actually change is going to take place, then these people who have helped this happen need to know that what they have done has contributed to tangible change. Many people, when they get to know me, are surprised that I am interested in things like astrology and tarot and magic and intuition and all of these things that are considered supernatural, paranormal, and lesser than other more, quote, objective ways of knowing. And I'm acutely aware of the skepticism that people have, coming as we do from centuries of believing in the scientific revolution values, that when we think of things like looking at sacred places, at spirits, at witches, at the non-living, and the universe as a whole, that it seems like a really crazy and very odd thing to do. But this skepticism to me just shows how powerful and how clever and how pervasive the ideas of the scientific revolution men were, and how successfully they managed to completely wipe out and degrade the kinds of ways of knowing that women, indigenous people had in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe and across the world. And we are actually very lucky that they didn't completely succeed, and that now we're starting to see that feminist, anti-colonial and anti-racist and queer approaches can try and get back some of this knowledge that they wiped out. It's time we all acknowledge that we don't know so much more than we do know, and that any kind of way of trying to understand our world shouldn't be discounted just because it has been ridiculed by the scientific community, and particularly these men from the scientific revolution. And even if we're not talking about socioeconomic research, these things are still so important today. They affect our everyday lives. For example, the trust and assumptions that the medical community know so much better than you yourself and your own body. We have lost our ability and our respect for the body that we have, the knowledge that we can get from its intuition and from the other ways of internal knowing. So I would love for us to counter this mind-body dualism by venerating and respecting the messages that our body has, particularly in our everyday lives. I hope you will join me in respecting all of the different ways of knowing. It is only through respecting these different ways of knowing that we can get as close as we're able to the truth. Thank you for listening to the Social Justice Salon with me, Marianne Moore. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. This podcast is brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. Patreon subscribers get these podcasts a week early, have access to exclusive content, and can be part of my private community. If you would like to work with me, I provide social justice and business advisory services for a range of needs. To find out more, please visit my website, createtricks.london. If you enjoyed this episode, then please take the time to give it a review or recommend it to a friend to help more listeners find us. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow the podcast at Social Justice Salon and me, Marianne, at creatrix.london on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted and produced by me, Marianne Moore. I did the artwork and the music was by the amazing Luke Fraser at The Tonic. Until next time, when I look forward to welcoming you back to the Social Justice Salon.